Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Many of you may not have dredged around in my CV that's attached to the Ask Dr. Dawn website, so you may not know that I have a degree in psychobiology, which was effectively what they used to call neuroscience. As a result of functional MRI, we have gained so much insight into the workings of the brain and the mind-body connection, which at the time I trained was largely disputed as somewhat spurious, but now is widely accepted as the neurohormonal axis has been fully articulated. Let me rephrase that. Fully articulated is a fantasy, but we know so much more than we did 30 years ago that we are beginning to be able to talk through the implanted circuitry and actually do amazing things. Like, for example, if a person thinks about their speech, like something they would like to say, and they have the right electrodes implanted, you can actually synthesize those sentences directly from a device and speak aloud the person's thoughts. Now, as long as that's voluntary, I guess we're cool, but I can see situations emerging, as always, in a post-apocalyptic or post-democralyptic setting where any of these tools could be abused. However, we're leaving that aside and venturing into the wonderful world of the mind-body interaction in health and disease. Our first article today is called Neural Anticipation of Viral Infection Triggers an Immune Response. As I said a moment ago, the mind-body connection, or psychoneuroimmunology, was pure theory and largely dismissed as New Age hocus-pocus when I trained by my teachers. However, now it is firmly established. And this article goes to take things a step further. Our thoughts actually talk to our white blood cells. How about that? Let's take a deeper dive. With respect to this article, let me start by saying that this is a very radical idea, but I think they have actually established plausibility using an elaborate and sophisticated method employing virtual reality to show that the functioning of innate lymphoid cells is altered by the thoughts formulated in an individual's head with presentation of a threatening stimulus of a sick person, but not when presented with a threatening stimulus in the nature of a violent event or, in fact, a neutral stimulus. This shows a level of precision beyond just the stress response that is an important aspect of establishing the neuroimmunology response as adapting to the nature of the stimulus. This is really groundbreaking. At this point, I'm going to read the abstract to you, but I'm going to stop when we have a complicated word that may not convey the concept to my audience, it being too jargonistic or technical for general consumption. So here we go. Neural Anticipation of Virtual Infection Triggers an Immune Response, published in Nature Neuroscience, July 28, 2025. Abstract. Once contact with a pathogen has occurred, it might be too late for the immune system to react. Here, we asked whether anticipatory neural responses might sense potential infections and signal to the immune system, priming it for a response. We show that potential contact with approaching infectious avatars entering the peripersonal space in virtual reality are anticipated by multisensory motor areas and activate the salience network as measured with psychophysics, electroencephalography, and functional magnetic resonance imaging. So let me rephrase that. Using virtual reality, you would see approaching you a person with runny nose, rash, watery eyes, sneezing, and they would be getting closer and closer, or they would just be at a set distance. Turns out that if the virtual avatar is approaching you, you get a stronger immune response than if It's visualized at 15 feet away. During the time that this is being done, the patients are being analyzed with EEGs, functional MRIs, and I'll explain the term psychophysics a little bit later when we get to the methods. Returning to the abstract, this proactive neural anticipation instigates changes in both the frequency and activation of innate lymphoid cells, mirroring responses seen in actual infections. So let's take a moment there. The white blood cells are primed to respond to chemical signals. These chemical signals are generally issued by other white blood cells or by damaged tissue. The interleukins, IL-1, IL-6, with which you may be familiar in the context of them going sky high during the COVID infection in people who were likely to end up in the ICU, are part of these chemical signals. Think of them as one of those rapid responses on your phone when you get a call and you don't want to take it, and you can click on, I'll call you later, or I'm on the phone, or I'm driving now. And imagine that these signals are automatically sent out by damaged tissue. I've been damaged. There's a hole in your body. Bacteria may enter. Please come help. That's pretty much how the immune system is set up. These are stereotypical signals, and as you might expect, they create a stereotypical response. Returning to the abstract, alterations in connectivity patterns between infection-sensing brain regions and the hypothalamus, along with modulation of neural mediators, connect these effects to the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. Network modeling recapitulates this immune crosstalk. Okay, let's go through that a bit because that was complex. So basically, there are parts of your brain that sense infection because they sense these chemicals, but also because they sense it in other ways. The hypothalamus is, well, kind of thermostat of the body. It controls things like your thyroid stimulating hormone. It controls the menstrual cycle. It controls the release of the gonads of testosterone and estrogen and progesterone. It controls all sorts of things, growth hormone, you name it, even appetite. There's a little subroutine somewhere in the hypothalamus that's taking care of, well, kind of just organizing the overall body response. It's an extremely important switching station. If I were going to put it in a corporate model, I would say that it's the chief operations officer of the body. Now, neural network modeling is a term that I think I have a little bit of trouble with. So, of course, I asked an AI, which is a remarkably amusing recursive thing for me to do when you think about it. Anyway, here's what the AI taught me about itself. Neural network modeling uses mathematical models structured like the human brain to process data and make predictions or decisions. These networks consist of interconnected nodes, quote-unquote neurons, organized in layers that learn by adjusting the strength of their connections, the weights, or in the real world, synapses, as they are exposed to examples. This allows the model to recognize complex patterns and approximate nonlinear functions, making it a powerful tool for tasks like image analysis, natural language processing, and forecasting processing. Okay, let me take a deep breath here. I'm going to climb inside my own head in a moment and talk about the emotion of disgust, being grossed out. Now, what are the things that do that automatically? I mean, the expression of disgust is a reflex expression. It's a set of facial muscle movements that are, well, if we imagine something gross, you'll feel your nose starting to wrinkle and draw together, almost like you're closing your nose. Your mouth will sort of rise up, the chin tightens. I mean, those are the things that happen in my face when I think about something rotting. Right? I kind of pucker up and squeeze all of my central facial features together. Now, that's a reflex, right? That is my brain thinking disgust, my thinking you, thinking a rotting corpse of an animal, thinking about opening a container from the back of the refrigerator and finding a new life form growing in there. There's also smell and certain smells. The smell of vomit, I think, is one that we can all realize that this is not an intellectual response. When you see or smell vomit, you just want to back away, okay? And that's activating more or less the same sort of thing we're talking about here. Some of these responses are just built in. We're born with them because they are adaptive. Just like if you think about a bird or think about a mama bird, all right? You can put any egg in there and the egg hatches and it starts opening its mouth and making, you know, feed me signals. The poor mother bird, even if her eggs, you know, have been taken away, will start feeding this thing. That's the whole thing about the parasitic bird, the cuckoo, right? It lays its eggs in a nest, destroys the other eggs, and kind of hijacks the parenting skills to create a daycare for its eggs and goes off and lays more eggs and therefore is a nest parasite. Well, this is kind of what we're talking about with this written code, we were born with it code. We have the circuitry and how it relates to us. We have the circuitry to recognize and avoid things that will make us sick, including other people who look sick. In my training as a physician, there is a lot of rewiring that took place in terms of reactions to poop, vomit, gross things in the body. They became neutral or even a little bit fascinating over the course of many years of training. And a lot of it was like immersion confrontation therapy, like when they take you into a room with a dead body and hand you a scalpel and a map and say, cut here. I mean, I remember my first day in anatomy class, it took an hour and we all had to dissect the chest wall and find one of the pectoral nerves. And that was all we had to do. But it took all of us a great deal of time to apply that scalpel to the skin. And a number of people just had to bail out of the class and go do deep breathing or vomit or a various number of things. I'm sure there's a kinder, gentler way to do that and get people used to it. But back in the day, like I said, they just took you into a room with a bunch of cadavers and handed you a scalpel and expected you to deal. Well, we do rewire. And whether it's through confrontation or through gentle guidance, I am recommending gentle guidance and computer modeling before you are actually brought into the place of cutting into flesh, dead or alive. But that's just because I am a nice person and I want to be nice to my students. It isn't because that's the only way. But it proves my point that there's a lot of built-in stuff here. And we're finally at the level where we can actually study it and prove what's going on and discover, and this is the big thing about this paper, that this is going on like right away with a very short duration. When you see someone who's sick, your immune system essentially activates to try and fight off any virus or bacteria that might make it across the room into you. And the extent of that modification, the extent of that activation, very rapid as it is also related to a calculation of how much of a threat this actually is. This is all going on at a subconscious level. You experience the emotion maybe of ew or ugh, but you don't decide to do it. It's the decision is made for you. So if you ever needed any proof that you are not in control of your body, that disgust response should tell you, yeah, it's true. I'm just riding this horse. I'm not driving this horse. I'm going to quote from the article again. In primates, a mechanism that might be functional to predict contact with potential harm has been described within a network of frontoparietal neurons. Think about the one that we train in to children. Hot, right? You've got the toddler, man. They see the pretty light. They're heading towards it. No, hot. Do not touch. You will be sorry, right? But that one has to be trained in because fire is something we invented, right? Essentially, we learn about hot because we're taught about it and have to be taught about it because it wasn't something we were going to encounter, at least at that level, in the natural world. I mean, you run from a forest fire before it comes anywhere near you, right? Big, scary thing. So what does that? Well, it's a system a network of neurons, some in the frontal cortex, some in the parietal cortex above your ear. And these integrate tactile stimuli on the body, which makes sense. That's where the parietal sensory, oh, that's touching my right finger, wiring is. So you also integrate it with stuff coming in from the occipital lobe. That thing is close to me. Oh, that sharp thing that just stuck me is that thing right there. And that actually creates a sort of virtual reality within the brain that's called the peripersonal space system, or PPS. So this PPS is there. It's a predictive system to avoid harm. And it seems to be what is activating in the course of this neuroimmuno connection. So what happens when an external stimulus comes in contact with the body? Well, I already described that in the sense of what the interleukins. You have a cut. Suddenly, the blood needs to clot. The platelets release interleukins that say, I've just found a cut. Right, you know, calling all cars. We need to get the forces in here in case bacteria enter this cut. So the immune system, as you probably know, has an early and a late arm. The early arm is innate. It's just programmed in, and it treats all potential harms equally and kind of destructively. It isn't nuanced, and it doesn't have a memory. Then there's the acquired immune system, and this is the adaptive immune system that we use when we want to vaccinate people, which comes into play after you have come in contact with a particular virus or bacteria that you've recognized as an enemy. You will evolve antibodies and T cells that are targeted to this enemy so that the time frame to fight that enemy is much shorter because you're pre-adapted to it. So it takes a concerted effort of these two arms to get rid of pathogens efficiently without damaging the host too much. I mean, you can kill a mosquito with a flamethrower. You really don't want to, because the damage from the mosquito is minimal compared to the damage from the flamethrower, at least to your house. So you could think of the innate immune system as having the flamethrower. And so we only want to use that when we are encountering something we haven't seen before and we know we're going to take a bigger hit. So that's why we build the more nuanced, kinder, gentler, targeted approach for the next time we encounter it. Now, obviously, autoimmunity comes in here. What if your adaptive response somehow misfires and you create a response against something that you've already got in the body, like your joints or your myelin sheath in your spinal column? Well, then you're going to have trouble, because that is always there. And when the immune system gets a alert from the brain, even this axis, right? We know that stress triggers attacks in intermittent relapsing multiple sclerosis. And we know that stress does that. What is stress? Stress is a response to a threat. So, wow, perceived threat triggers multiple sclerosis. We see that phenomenologically. But now we're getting down to the nuts and bolts of exactly what's going on here. I'm finding it fascinating. I hope you are as well. So up until now, there's been no evidence that there's an interaction between the behavioral and the biological immune systems. It's like you see something gross, you avoid it. But what we haven't known until now, and I think it's established by this paper, is that there's an avoidance response, but there's also an immune activation response that follows a very clear set of protocols. Quoting the paper again, here we asked whether the human brain is equipped with a mechanism of early sensing and anticipation of contact with virtual infections that is able to trigger a reaction of early players in the immune system, that is to say the innate lymphocytes, for example, innate lymphoid cells and natural killer cells, that's similar to what occurs when reacting to contact with a physical pathogen. We exposed healthy participants to potential infection threats using virtual reality in the form of human faces displaying clear signs of infection, these we call infectious avatars, and entering participants' personal protective space. By using psychophysics, EEG, and functional magnetic resonance, fMRI mass spectrometry and flow cytometry, we measured behavioral, neural, and immune responses to infectious avatars compared to responses evoked by control stimuli or actual contact with pathogens, that is to say, injection of a flu vaccine. Our results show that potential contact with virtual infection threats is predicted by frontoparietal areas of the personal protective space system. It activates the salience networks and triggers a cascade of neuroimmune mediators, ultimately inducing changes to innate lymphocyte frequency and activation. Translation: someone coughing and sneezing in your face in the virtual reality activates your early immunity response just as quickly as a flu shot. Time for a little personal anecdote. When I was 11 years old, I was plucked out of a fairly boring classroom in the LA City school system and taken to a magic land, the Science Enrichment Center. Oh, they had me at hello. They had microscopes and they had petri dishes and they had frogs to dissect, and it was just a different kind of play for an 11-year-old, but it was an opening into the fascinating world of biology. They also worked on mathematics and amounted to computer skills, but oh man, it was the biology that grabbed me. And as a result, I departed on my path to become a true science geek, a lifelong reader of scientific experiments. And certain topics, as you know, fascinate me, like the microbiome and genomics. These have all developed within my lifetime, and I've had the great privilege of watching these fields expand and move to a level of depth and determinism that I couldn't have even imagined. No one could have imagined back in the 60s. So here we are. We're not on the moon, but we're like building new species and wiping out diseases by changing the genetics of the cancer. I guess that's worth commenting on. We put our energy in a different direction, but we have come very, very far. So I always read method sections. That's part of the science geek in me. And I really appreciate a well-designed methodology and one that thinks about, well, how can we double-check this? How can we make absolutely or as close as possibly sure that we're not fooling ourselves? Because, hey, if you invest lots of money in 3 or 4 years in your life to trying to do a certain level of science or make a certain discovery or prove a certain mechanism, you have an emotional investment in actually succeeding. It's very hard to walk away from a failed study. And so you really want to get it right, and you really want to be able to prove that you got it right and be subject to the critical analysis of your peer group, who is also, I might add, in competition with you for grants, and may or may not support your research, and you have to be prepared to defend your thesis, shall we say, against all comers who are in fact coming to examine it carefully and break apart your alibi. So let's talk about the methods section. First of all, I want to talk about the virtual reality protocol. Participants were first exposed to a neutral avatar, basically a neutral face, and then assigned to one of three cohorts encountering neutral, infectious, or fearful avatars in a second section. So the fearful avatar is someone with their mouth open, their jaw open, their eyebrows up, their eyes wide. Startle. Think about the expression of being startled. The neutral avatar is like one of those computer neutral perfect faces that you'll see. And the infectious avatar basically has either leprosy or very bad facial shingles, you know, red face, red eyes, blistering rash on the face. Definitely the sort of thing that you feel like you might be able to catch. They also did something called the personal protective space task. Participants responded to tactile stimuli on their face, in other words, touching their face, delivered either in an empty space where there was no one nearby, and nothing in the VR field, or combined with an approaching avatar. They called this the multisensory phase. So tactile stimuli were presented at five delays, with the avatar located at one of five distances, near and close, basically. You can see that the personal protective response changed depending upon how close the avatar was. Reaction times to multisensory stimuli, that is to say, both the visual and the tactile, were normalized and plotted for avatar distance. They followed EEG responses, and things get very technical here, so I'm just going to tell you that what they saw was that the closer it was, when coupled with having your face touched, the stronger and more rapid the response. So here's a fun fact that came out of it. Your reaction time to a facial touch was measured, and the setup was you had to push a button when you felt your face to be touched. Okay, you're in VR, so you can't see anything coming at you. And your reaction time to touching the button varied depending upon whether you had an approaching neutral avatar or an approaching infectious avatar. In other words, the brain was already making the calculus, danger, Will Robinson, and upping your reaction time, kind of in a fight or flight adaptive loop, right? Now, here's the thing. Neutral avatars did not increase your response, even if they were approaching rapidly. However, the infectious avatar did increase your response. And these are people who are being told to push the button as fast as possible. So they developed superpowers in terms of the speed of them being able to push the button when a threat was coming at them. So they also learned to read the EEG, 128-channel EEG. That's a high-density one. And what they saw was that they could read the spike and the shape of the spike in the parietal and premotor areas. And there was a difference between the near and far approaching avatar versus far avatar. And this was, of course, the response time. So they were able essentially to read it going on in the EEG and see the difference. To sum it up, somebody who looks like a zombie running towards you is going to make you run faster. More methods, but cool stuff. We then tested whether virtual infections trigger an actual immune response. A new sample of participants was first exposed to neutral avatars, and then blood samples were taken immediately after the neutral VR stimulation to define an equivalent baseline. They then divided them into three cohorts. They were matched previously for sensitivity to disgust and anxiety. We've got some variability there. And so they wanted to be sure that the three cohorts had, you know, roughly the same scores. Then they were exposed to infectious, neutral, or fearful avatars, and the blood samples were taken after VR stimulation. To compare the immune response to virtual infection with a real pathogen, we tested a fourth cohort of participants that were not stimulated with VR, but received an influenza vaccine, an ethically acceptable surrogate model for pathogen inoculation in humans. We assessed the early antigen-independent phase of the lymphoid response by measuring the peripheral blood frequency and activation of innate lymphocytes, that is to say, innate lymphocyte cells and natural killer cells. Results revealed that virtual and real infections induced a stronger modulation of innate lymphocyte cells' frequency and activation indexes, as evaluated by clinical expression of different activation markers, CD25, CD27, CD69, NKP30, and a whole list of others. Now, let me stop for a moment and explain that when a white blood cell is activated, it displays a different pattern. Think of an octopus, all right? We know that octopuses can change their skin color. You can read their emotions by their skin color. Well, white blood cells are exactly the same way. They have the equivalent of chromatophores on their surface. These are the surface markers. So think of the CD25 and the NKP44 and all of this other alphabet soup as just arbitrary designations for a signal saying in service, right? Or out of service. The white blood cells are wandering around like a bus, you know, not in service, don't flag me down. Taxis, not in service. Uber people just take themselves off of the site and you don't see them. They just wander around looking for trouble, looking for a ride. And then when they get stimulated, they pop up their little flag and now you're in a taxi and the meter is running. And the battle has been joined. And the response is pretty fast. They drew blood immediately after establishing baseline. Then they got their exposure. They had a 20-minute cohort-specific virtual reality, so either control or control as in neutral, or the fearful or the infected. Blood samples were collected immediately after that 20-minute cohort. In the vaccine cohort, the samples were collected before and after flu vaccination. So about a 120-minute time altogether for both groups between the first and second blood sample. So then they took the mononuclear cells, the monocytes, and they stained them and they ran through flow cytometry and looked for markers. And what they saw was a mirror. The flu shot and the virtual infection exposure caused a similar strong decrease in the suppressor circulating cells and an increase in the aggressor circulating cells. We use these expressions instinctively. Gut feeling. Butterflies in my stomach. That was a punch in the gut. We do it because we know that our emotions and our intestinal functioning are closely related. We know it intuitively, but now science is unpacking exactly how that connection works. Our second article today comes from the Journal of Physiology. This was published a couple of years ago in September of 2023. The impact of acute and chronic stress on gastrointestinal physiology and function, a microbiota gut-brain axis perspective. I'll begin with the extract. The physiological consequences of stress often manifest in the GI tract. Traumatic or chronic stress is associated with widespread maladaptive changes throughout the gut, but comparatively little is known about the effects of acute stress. Furthermore, these stress-induced changes in the gut may increase susceptibility to gastrointestinal disorders and infection. They may also impact critical features of the neural and behavioral consequences of the stress response by impairing gut-brain axis communication. So understanding the mechanisms behind changes in the gut nervous system circuitry, the sensitivity of the intestines to external and internal stimuli, the barrier function of the intestines, the permeability of the gut to external environmental substances, and changes in the gut microbiota following stress are important research objectives. There are important pathological implications in both neurogastroenterology and psychiatry. Moreover, the gut microbiota has emerged as a key aspect of physiology sensitive to the effects of stress. In this review, we will be focusing on different aspects of the GI tract, including gut barrier function, as well as the immune, humoral, and neuronal elements involved in gut-brain communication. A key function of the stress response is to promote survival by coordinating behavior and freeing up energy for immediate use by releasing the body's energy reserves and inhibiting competing energy-intensive processes which are not essential for immediate survival. In other words, fight or flight turns off digestion. When faced with a stressor, our body adapts through activation of two independent systems, which primarily exist to prepare us to adequately respond to a perceived stressor. These are the sympathoadrenomedullary axis of the autonomic nervous system and the HPA or hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. Let's take a moment to look at the adrenal gland. It sits like a French beret on top of the kidney, hence the term adrenal. It consists primarily of one structure wrapped around another. The external structure is the adrenal medulla. This is responsible for producing epinephrine and releasing it, flushing it really, whoosh, into our bloodstream. Have you ever had the experience of a near miss while driving? And then, like two heartbeats later, your heart is pounding and you're feeling a certain level of psychological distress. But it's after the event. It's after you've swerved. It's after whatever was happening has finished happening. And yet you have 15, maybe 20 seconds of rapid heartbeat and pounding heartbeat. And then it just sort of quiets down fairly rapidly. What you're experiencing is that squirt or flush of adrenaline from the adrenal gland into your bloodstream. It's stimulated by a direct neural connection to the brain that represents the immediate reaction to threat, the fight or flight reaction. The second phase, the pounding, well, it takes that long for the blood to reach your heart. And then the third phase, the gradual easing off of the pounding heart rate, that's the enzymes, the molecular scissors, in your bloodstream simply chopping up the adrenaline. It's not allowed to stay in the bloodstream very long. It's rapidly broken down. Inside the medulla, there's the other half of the adrenal gland. This is the part of the adrenal gland that produces cortisol and aldosterone, a so-called mineralocorticoid that affects the way your kidney handles salt, potassium, and water, balancing these compounds in your bloodstream so that your nerves and your heart function properly. The other half, cortisol, we're all familiar with. That's the stress hormone. It's the anti-inflammatory hormone. It's an important signaling hormone to the rest of our body. It does interesting things, like making us gain weight when it's chronic. High levels of cortisol are also associated with poor sleep and a dysregulation of the body clock, a sort of called permanent state of jet lag. When people receive outside cortisol to treat perhaps an autoimmune disease or the side effects of cancer therapy, they can become immunosuppressed and develop certain quote-unquote stigmata or physical signs of excess cortisol. These can include colored stretch marks on the torso, similar to what pregnant women develop, and also accumulation of fat on the back of the neck, sometimes called the buffalo hump. Oh yes, they can also develop diabetes and elevated blood sugar and insulin resistance. Interestingly enough, the body will also steal the basic skeleton of the steroid hormones, which is cholesterol. They'll divert production of testosterone and estrogen to production of cortisol if high levels are being required because of signals coming from the brain related to chronic stress. There's also a couple of diseases called Cushing's disease and Cushing's syndrome, where for one reason or another, the body produces drastically high levels of cortisol, escaping the usual controls which come from the pituitary gland. This doesn't make a lot of sense until you realize that in evolution, there's really only one form of chronic stress, and that's starvation. So the effect of cortisol in a chronic stress situation is adaptive. It helps turn down the immune system. It helps turn down the metabolism. It helps store fat. It helps hold on to sugar so it can be converted to fat. It makes you tired so that you don't move around so much. Now, that's all very adaptive in a starvation situation, but why it's maladaptive in our modern world is because we've invented so many new, colorful, and addictive forms of chronic stress. Here's a list of some of the diseases that are associated with chronic stress. Irritable bowel syndrome, osteoporosis, diabetes, hypertension, elevated cholesterol, depression, and neurologic degeneration. There are certain things that predispose to this. Traumatic experiences, especially if occurring in childhood, genetic background, and repeated exposure to stress alone and in combination with helplessness or inability to cope with the stressors and escape them. We have to think of acute and chronic stress as having a fuzzy border. It's not like you cross a doorway and suddenly you're in chronic stress. As far as the gut is concerned, prolonged stressor would be greater than an hour, and repeated stress exposures occurring over several days have been shown to evoke changes to the enteric nervous system, affecting gut motility by slowing it down, increasing visceral sensation, which would manifest as gas, pain, or cramps, impairing gut barrier function, thus allowing for the release of compounds from the gut that are pro-inflammatory, and changing the gut microbiome. Now, the gut has a direct connection to the brain called the vagus nerve. And in recent years, we've come to realize that it's not just signals from the brain that stimulate digestion. It's signals from the gut, and sometimes chemicals produced in the gut, such as serotonin, which migrate up to the brain and alter brain function. So let's take a moment to contrast the effects of acute and chronic stress on the gut. So let's start with a healthy gut-brain axis, just chugging along. You see the food, you smell the food, you start to salivate, you release stomach acid, your peristaltic waves recognize these signals, and then when the stomach distends, it starts to contract. This is a reflex from the stretch receptors happening locally. So you have essentially filling the washing machine from the brain and the signals there, and then starting the agitation cycle when the laundry is in the machine. Now, in the situation of acute stress, remember I said the fight or flight is redirecting energy away from the gut. So whether you have food in your stomach or not, you're going to lower your peristalsis. It's just going to sit there while you send that blood and oxygen to different muscles, the ones involved in running, perhaps, or fighting. There's also a activation of the immune system, similar to the kind of activation we might see with, say, a flu shot. That is because we want the immune system, the innate immune system, to get ready and be activated so that it will attack any bacteria that it comes across as a result of a wound or a bite. Paradoxically, we also see decreased cellular immune function. And the reason for this is that that's very energy intensive. Those white blood cells are, for the most part, really pigs when it comes to the energy they consume. And right now, our ability to deal with that is simply not priority one. Now, in a situation of chronic stress, we have a lot of things going on. The allergic and mast cells that are typically present in the gut as part of the immune armamentarium become activated and are more likely to release histamine. This can lead to sudden stress-induced diarrhea with eating a meal. This is because the histamine release can also sensitize us to becoming sensitized to food, but more importantly, it's a direct stimulant of peristalsis and a fluid leakage into the gut, so watery diarrhea. We also see increased permeability of the gut wall. Part of that is due to thinning of the mucus layer, which is not being made because, again, we have too many other things to be concentrating on, so we've diverted energy away from this. We have increased migration of immune cells into the gut, and we have increased production by those mast cells of antibacterial IgE, and the gut itself begins to make antibacterial IgA. It can also start making IgA against foods which are present in the gut at that time. It's a sort of nondescript self immunization against the foods that you eat most commonly, and the combination of increased permeability and stimulation of local IgA production can also often be the trigger for the development of celiac disease in immunologically and genetically susceptible individual. Another really interesting thing that happens with chronic stress is that the bacteria read the cortisol and begin behaving differently. So the microbial metabolites such as dopamine and serotonin shift. The gut microbiota also loses its stability, and it's more easy for an overgrowth or a monocropping sort of phenomenon to begin. Because of the leakiness, broken bits of bacteria are more likely to cross over into the lymphoid tissue surrounding the gut, and the nerves become irritated by this, and so the amount of gas or abdominal distension that an ordinary person would be able to tolerate is drastically reduced. This is one of the findings that we see in irritable bowel syndrome, which is that if you put a balloon in the bowel and blow it up, you can't blow it up nearly as much without causing pain in an individual with irritable bowel syndrome compared to an individual without it. Before we move on to the functional MRI data, I'm going to take a little side trip into this concept called the salience network. The salience network is defined as an ensemble of interconnected brain regions whose major role is detecting and filtering stimuli, looking for salience, that is to say, important stimuli like threats or food or sex or boring. If you filter out the boring and you're left with threat, food, and sex, you're pretty much describing the reason we have a salience network. Now, of course, variations in salience network are important, and there's probably some biological adaptation of females to be more gatherers and spotting small differences in plants and small differences in the behavior of children, whereas males may be better at tracking game or interpreting sounds. This needs to be studied in a whole bunch of people to elaborate, but it's a large branch of neuroscience right now. But I think you can understand now what the salience network is. And it's certain places in the parietal and the frontal lobes. And the way that the MRI, the functional MRI, deals with this, okay, let's take a walk through the other networks. I want you to imagine that you're lying on the beach, it's warm, you're comfortable, you can feel the sun on the surface of your body, you can hear the wave, you can hear some seagulls, you're not really thinking about anything at all, you're just kind of drifting, you're having some random thoughts, but you're not really following chill. And then on your next breath, you smell something really, really good, some kind of food cooking, the smell of grilled meat, perhaps, if you're not a vegetarian. Yum. Well, that is the salience network intruding upon the default mode network. The default mode network is what's active when a person is at rest or not particularly focused on the external world. If you're thinking about something or daydreaming, it's considered to be remembering, future planning. It's also used in when you're sort of sitting in class and not paying attention. You're definitely in default mode network under those circumstances. So let's talk about the central executive network. It's engaged in goal-oriented tasks that require high-level cognitive control. So managing attention, keeping things in working memory, solving problems, making decisions. It's sort of the yang to the default mode network's yin. The salience network acts as a switch. It detects the triggers and flips you into analytic, right? So, what am I smelling? Well, let's see. Or, that smells like a fire. I better open my eyes and see if I'm in danger. And indeed, you are in danger. Something is approaching that's a threat. Well, boom, into problem solving. Your attention is focused. You're making decisions. And you're going to be making some deliberate effort here. Another network is called the somatosensory network. This processes sensations from the body. It's critical for tactile recognition, touch, object recognition through touch, storing sensory memories. Somatosensory network. Let's get that massage. Let's be, just so relaxed and so happy because we're having a massage and it feels just wonderful. Now, the somatosensory network has strong links to the hippocampus and the amygdala. This helps integrate sensory experiences into memory and also assign value, pleasure, pain, etc., to the experience. And lastly, we have the limbic network. This is a series of interconnected structures involved in emotion, motivation, and memory, also including the hippocampus and the amygdala, but also the hypothalamus. There's your stress response, folks, and your cingulate gyrus, which is very important in sensing sensation, particularly pain. The limbic network interacts heavily with the cerebral cortex. And when these disruptions get messed up, we get disorders like PTSD. So to get back to our experiment, how do you identify changes in the salience network, whether it's been triggered? Well, you use BOLD, blood oxygen level dependent responses. In other words, if the neurons are firing, the blood flow to that part of the brain increases, and we can see that. We can see what's working with functional MRI. Parenthetically, I am really grateful to functional MRI because it finally put to bed the idea that acupuncture and other forms of mind-body manipulation are just imaginary. The changes that we see with acupuncture for pain are identical to the changes we see with morphine and other analgesics for pain in certain areas of the brain, and they match the subjective reports of pain relief. In real life, when the salience network detects a threat, it activates the frontal amygdala, hypothalamus, and periaqueductal gray regions of the brain, and also the lateral hypothalamus, which is a key area in the regulation of the innate immune response. So what happens in fight or flight? Well, there's a flood of catecholamines, that is to say epinephrine, adrenaline, into the bloodstream via the sympathetic nervous system, and also direct signals sent to the heart, the adrenal glands, and the gut, telling it to either turn up or turn down. The adrenal gland receives instructions to release corticosteroids from the adrenal cortex. And on top of that, you have additional modulation factors going on, including how inflamed or activated is the particular system in the first place. Is this happening in a person who's a daily meditator and a very chill personality, or is it happening in someone who's overworked mother of three children who's chronically stressed? So as they looked for changes in this activity, they found that there was a really different kind of modulation in the hypothalamus when there were infectious avatars present than compared to neutral avatars. So basically, the presence of the infectious avatars increased the salience, increased the activity in those areas where the control of the immune system is taking place. Now, a very interesting finding, which was not something that these researchers set off to figure out, was what was the threshold for engaging in fight or flight? And the fight or flight response, I should say, is one that sets off this whole cascade of immune upregulation, which is beneficial when there is, in fact, a threat, but is also hard on the body and leads to the production of inflammatory agents and an inflammatory immune response, which can backfire, as in the case of autoimmune disease, or exhaust itself in the case of chronic stress leading to increased vulnerability to infections because cortisol has been released all the time. And essentially, we no longer have a good adaptive or innate immune response to what comes at us. Strong associations with the potential of not being able to fight off early cancers ensue, as well as an increased vulnerability to infectious disease. So we would rather avoid the mirage causing an activation of these innate immunity functions while they keep us safe. If we don't need to be kept safe, it's a bad idea to pull this trigger. What they didn't expect but found was that the proximity was a specific issue with this study. So if the threat was 20 feet away from you, subjectively in the VR, you didn't fire an immune response unless it was coming closer to you. So social distancing, which was done initially as a way of trying to reduce your exposure to inhaled particulates of COVID or tuberculosis, for that matter, if you go back 100 years, that social distancing actually has an additional beneficial effect, which is that you don't trigger your innate immune response through this mechanism of fight or flight being activated by what you see, even if the threat is, to your knowledge, not really a threat. There are implications for going on a media diet, for example, and not doom scrolling, because by doing so, you're activating this innate immune response when you don't need it. And there's a cost to that, to your general health and well-being and ability to resist infection and your probability of developing autoimmune disease. So, yeah, we need to control and avoid triggering our fight or flight response. I've been recommending that people read their news and do not watch videos, because when you read something without images, you have to create the images. And as you create the images, they're more schematic, if you will, and therefore less likely to trigger this response. They're not as threatening to the sort of, let's call it robotic protective responses. But what we're doing right now to ourselves with our screens and our phones and our feeds is we're hurting ourselves. We're causing chronic inflammation. What should we do instead? Well, I have some specific advice. When you wake in the morning, do not immediately go to your phone. Go outside. Breathe the air. Look at the sky. Maybe you even have birds to listen to. Look at the colors in the sky if you're getting up early. Otherwise, look at something that is calm and calming, like a plant. But when you wake in the morning, don't immediately activate your fight or flight response. Same thing for the evening. If you're going to watch the television, and I've talked about this in the sleep hygiene aspects of the program that I've done numerous times, wear some amber colored glasses, have a screen filter, don't be throwing blue light in your eyes. Turn off your phone, put your phone into I'm not picking up except for allowed alarms, like I have a fire safety thing that will ring through. But the point is, you need some downtime. In fact, if you do get provoked or fearful, take a moment, take 5 minutes and breathe it out. Get rid of it. Don't perseverate. Have some kind of go-to strategy that brings it down. Even simple deep breathing will do the trick. But you've got to spend the 5 minutes to be healthy. Otherwise, you're going to burn yourself out. And we are living in a world where that's so tantalizing and so addictive and so stimulated. But the algorithms were not built with the intention of keeping us healthy. They were built with the intention of keeping our attention. And the best way to keep our attention is to scare us. Right. Oh, dear. Talk about Frankenstein's monster. So I'll leave you with this. Breathe in slowly to the count of five. Now hold your breath for the count of five. Now breathe out slowly for the count of five. Now hold your breath for the count of five. Now breathe in slowly for the count of five. And as you breathe in the second time, you'll notice that you actually enjoy that breathing because you changed your blood pH with that 5-second hold. You changed your blood pH in a positive way, in a way that's calming to your immune system. So 5 minutes of that, 5 beats in, 5 beats out. You can use a clock. It's a great way. 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 is also decent. But you find that you kind of have to focus to do it right. And it's hard to carry any, oh my God, thoughts in your head and keep the count going, which is exactly the point. So if you are going to watch television and watch the disasters happening and watch and do the doom scrolling, when you're done, do the breathing. I can't guarantee that it'll extend your life, but I'll just say that the data certainly supports this practice for exactly that purpose. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.